Saru Kwayusi, el tiran vent, le nanot de quelle che me mette agitación. O che non sai che, ma quanto il tiran vent la ensi.
Welcome to Italy Inside Out. I'm your host, Andrea Aldrich. As a tour guide, I am in Italy often, sharing my favorite sights and hidden gems to my tour groups. But traveling to Italy is not an option during this pandemic, and I'm missing my favorite European country. I miss the incredible art. I miss Euphemia's ravioli and Giuseppe's Vinsanto. I miss the colors and the textures of the villages and the landscapes. I miss my favorite gelateria and a good cup of Italian espresso. But most of all, I miss the people. If you're yearning to be in Italy again, or to visit for the first time, I hope listening to the stories and discussions with my friends and other people knowledgeable about things Italian will help to keep your travel flame lit until it is safe again to visit Italia. I'm so happy to have my good friend Mary Beth Moser with me today. Mary Beth is a writer and a lecturer, and she's also spent many years on a quest to learn about her cultural heritage in the region of Trentino. And she's agreed to share with us some of the stories and insights that she's encountered along the way. Hello, Mary Beth. Welcome.
Hello, Andrea. I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
The region we're talking about today is located in northern Italy, and it shares its northern border with Austria and Switzerland. It's an Italian region a bit unusual because it is comprised of two autonomous provinces, each with its own capital city. The northern province has two names associated with it, Alto Adige and Sud Tyrol. The southern province is called Trentino. I understand that this region was actually part of Austria at one time.
Yeah, it was. It was, you know, it's always been, and I'm not a historian, but it's got a really complex history. It's a borderland because it's the Alps. It's at the very northern end of what is now considered Italy. So the Alps create the border, and as borderland, it's always a little contested. It's kind of the gateway from the Mediterranean to the rest of Europe. So for 800 years, it was a principality. So it makes it a really interesting area politically. It was ruled by prince bishops from about the year 1000 to the year 1800, that time frame. And there are still castles there. So when you go there, you'll see castles at the head of many of the valleys. And the rulers there were responsible to both the king or the emperor in Rome and the head of the church, the pope. So they had two alliances. And then after, it was a contested area during World War I. If you are interested in the war, there's still, you know, it was fought right in the mountains there. So it's very much part of the history of the people. Every little village has a war memorial for both World War I, which they called the Great War, and World War II. So it took a terrible toll on the lives of the people. But after World War I, that part of land that was part of Austria became part of Italy. My grandparents' birth certificates actually all say Austria, but the language is Italian, but truly their language was dialect. So that area up there is very mountainous. It's formed by the glaciers a long time ago. And so it's mountains and valleys and rivers, and each valley became pretty isolated and had their own variation of the language. So, for example, my grandmother's true language was not Italian. It was something called dialect. And some people still speak it there today. It's got an interesting cadence. It's almost like singing. If you hear Italian enough from all over Italy, you'll recognize the cadence of the language from up there. And it's kind of sing-songy. But there are numerous dialects up there. And, you know, people in their own village and valley spoke a common language, and over the centuries it took on its own form, and they still exist today. They're trying to bring them back. It's really an important part of the cultural history of the area, is the original language that the people spoke, which is some form of Italian, but not exactly. Some of the dialects still bear traces of when the Romans came 2,000 years ago and conquered the area. Three of the dialects are protected as their own languages. They're considered that important. The one in my grandmother's valley, Val di Sole, is not protected yet, but it's very similar to one of the languages that are protected. So I don't actually know how my grandparents communicated. They met here in the United States as immigrants, but their dialects were different because they came from different villages and valleys.
You didn't learn about your cultural heritage in Trentino until you were a young adult in college. Isn't that true?
Yeah, really, after college. That's an interesting story. You know, I really was raised without an explicit knowledge of my culture. And it's a very similar story to many immigrants, I think, that immigrated at the beginning of the 1900s, where it was really important to assimilate and become, quote, Americans and leave your culture behind. The people that immigrated from Trentino were really a small stream of a large river of Italian immigration. So the story from there often gets lost. They immigrated to the mountains, often to the small towns where there were mining communities. So because they were from the Alps and they were used to the altitude and the cold weather, they were often recruited to be miners. And so they weren't in the cities. Some were, of course, but my own grandparents went to the mountains of Colorado, where my grandfathers worked as miners, and a lot of Trentini, people from Trentino, worked in the mines. Where you find mountains, you often find precious minerals of some kind, and then you'll find mines, and then you'll almost always find Trentini who were immigrants there. So that's dispersed across the whole country, also in South America and Canada as well, and Mexico. But a lot of the immigrants lost their lives. So my paternal grandfather, Giovanni Moser, I actually learned they pronounce it Moser over there, which sounds French, not Italian, but they've been in Italy, that part of what is now Italy, for at least 500 years. I never knew my paternal grandfather. My maternal grandfather, Emmanuel Faustini, died when I was just 7 years old. So I do remember him. He spoke English with an accent. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, Edvige Albazini, died before I was born. So I never knew her. I never heard her say a word of anything. And then I knew my paternal grandmother. She died when I was 17. And she spoke English with an accent, but that's all I ever heard. They did speak the dialect at home, but when my mother was growing up and her siblings, but because they were gone, they had died before I was born, I never heard a word of anything other than English. I never heard a word of dialect growing up because my grandmother was already gone. However, my mother grew up hearing dialect spoken at home, and then she would respond in English. So she had a kind of secret language, which I never knew about. After I learned about my culture as an adult, and I went to Italy and found all the villages of my grandparents, where they were from, it was really one of the happiest events of my life to discover my heritage and learn where I was from and to walk on the land of all four of my grandparents. And I was so thrilled about this. I insisted that my parents come to Italy to see where their parents were from. And so we made a great journey and I got to show them all of the places. In my grandmother's village, we showed up, we were on public transportation, we took the bus and we showed up on foot, and I had arranged to meet a cousin that I had met the year before. She was going to host us. Well, she happened to be at the store when we arrived. You know, she walked to the little grocery store every day to get her food for the day. Everything was on foot. She never drove a car. So we showed up and she wasn't there. And the woman from upstairs called down and she was speaking in dialect. And she said, "Oh, Daria, my cousin, isn't home. She went to the store." And she started talking on and on. And even though by now I had studied Italian and knew a fair amount of it, she was speaking in the dialect and I couldn't understand her. And my mother was at my side and she was shaking her head yes, as if she understood everything this woman was saying. And I said, "Mom," I said, "please don't shake your head yes, because I really don't understand what she's saying." And my mom looked at me and she said, "Oh, but I do." And my mother understood perfectly everything this woman said because she had grown up hearing my grandmother speak. And this was all a revelation to me. I just called it her secret language. I never knew there was a secret language. I mean, I never knew that she knew it or could understand it or speak it. And she hadn't heard or spoken a word of dialect in 30 years. It had been that long since her mother died. So she took over the translation job, you know. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, I understood and could speak Italian to some degree, but the true language of the people there is the dialect. And so it was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling to watch my mother converse in this other language.
That was such a great story, Mary Beth, about your mother. I loved hearing it. How many of your relatives do you think you have found so far in the region?
I have quite a few cousins there. I'm still learning. And one thing about Trentino, it's kind of funny. It's not that big. It's mountainous. So, you know, it'll take a little while to get from one end to the other, but you can certainly drive from one end to the other in a day. But because it's been, people have been in that area for hundreds, well, I mean, humans have been there since the glaciers receded 10,000 years ago. So, you know, people move back in as soon as they could, as soon as, you know, the last ice age started melting, the humans moved back in. So the archaeology there, fascinating archaeological evidence there, tells us that people have been there for a long time and they've left their marks. They've marked, you know, they've marked them in the rocks and left their tools. But because they were, even though they journeyed within valleys, you know, for trade purposes and craft and professions, they've been there for a long time. And so There's a joke that we're all related, and I think we are all cousins there. So you don't have to go too far to meet somebody that's related. In fact, if I gave somebody my name or one of my four grandparents' surnames, they would know right where I'm from, more or less. And so, like having the name Moser or Moser, there's just a few places in Trentino, and the Mosers have been there, as I said, for at least 500 years. There's a famous bicycle rider called Francesco Moser, and one of the priests in his village traced his family tree, and it went back to right around 1300s or so, where the counts brought in of Bavaria, opened up that land and brought in people to clear the land and plant vineyards. And so his family tree goes back that far, and I'm sure we're related, you know, to that original family that came in. And they settled in a few villages, and they're still there. So it's a beautiful thing about that area. Given your name, you can find where you're from, and you can find all sorts of people with that same surname or cognome, and you can find relatives. So the village that my grandfather's from, Giovanni Moser, you know, at the time, the first time I showed up, there's about 500 people there. And I met a Moser, a woman named Moser, on the bus on my way to the village. And I told her my name, and I was looking for relatives. And she brought me home with her. And, you know, I started showing her the names of who my family were. And she was helping me sort out all the family trees. And within an afternoon, she knew who I was related to. And it wasn't her family. We're not related. But she knew which Moser family I was related to, and she pointed me in the right direction, and she told me which bus to take. And so I was able to meet my relatives that very day, thanks to this woman, Carmela, who graciously took me home with her and helped me figure out which branch of the family was mine. And it's really confusing as a genealogist, because especially with so many people named the same name. So my grandfather was Giovanni Moser. There are dozens of Giovanni Mosers. And so which one is mine? Which family is mine? Many Giovanni Mosers immigrated to America. So even that wasn't a discerning factor, because there were so many immigrants. So what they've done, it's so smart. There's something called a sopranome. An above name is how you'd literally translate it, but it's a nickname. And so if you know the sopranome of your family, it's kind of like identifying which family branch is yours. So it becomes a way of telling what branch of the tree that you're from. And so that became a key thing, learning what my sopranome was. Yes, in answer to your question, I have all kinds of cousins, probably everybody there. And even 2 years ago, I was there. I stayed in a valley, a beautiful valley that I love to stay in, not far from my relatives. And I struck up a conversation with this beautiful young woman at the tourist information booth. I was asking her where to find the location of this particular folk story that I'm interested in. And she was so helpful. We talked for an hour. And at the end of the conversation, I happened to ask her name. And she, as typical, she gave me her first name and her last name. And I recognized the last name as that of my great-grandmother. And I said, "That's my great-grandmother's last name." Well, we decided that afternoon that we were, you know, I told her a few of my family names, and she told me a few of hers. She called her father, because she's a young person. And so by the end of the day, we decided that we were related. And in fact, now we've discovered I came home and did a lot more work on it. And her father's great-grandmother and my great-grandmother were sisters. And so I don't know if there was some sort of genetic resonance, you know, when we talked. I did feel a certain affinity with her, and I still feel very fond of her. So I'm still encountering and discovering relatives. It's really quite a phenomenal thing. It really speaks to how we're all one family in this world, because I'm pretty sure all of our family trees in this area, if you could go back far enough, are intertwined.
I can only imagine how elated you must feel each time you encounter a new relative. Okay, I'm going to change the subject a little bit now. Let's talk about something that is near and dear to every Italian, and that is food. Each Italian region seems to be known for particular traditional dishes. Can you tell us some of the traditional dishes that are prepared in Trentino?
Well, you know, that's what's interesting. The food is like the language, like the terrain. It's got its own food up there. And, you know, part of it, it's at higher elevation. So what food people everywhere for most of our period of human history have eaten the foods that they could grow locally. So they make food and grow food that grow at those altitudes. And although there are some pockets of Mediterranean climate up there, it's generally at a higher altitude. So some of the dishes, I don't know even if people would recognize them, the names, but they're potato-based. One of the dishes is called gnocchi. It's a kind of a potato dumpling, and it's gained some fame, I would say, you know, in the last 10 or 20 years. G-N-O-C-C-H-I, gnocchi. When you see words that have that G-N in them, that's very typical spelling of that region. So gnocchi is a dumpling that is popular up there. Another kind of dumpling is called knitterli. That's a dialect word, probably Germanic in origin, but spelled as an Italian word would be spelled. And it's a dumpling made with bread and meat. My Aunt Emma was really skilled in making knitterli when I went and visited her and did a formal interview of her. She cooked homemade knitterli for me, and she said she made it for the family every Sunday growing up. So she was definitely an expert at making this delicious. They're big. They're about the size of a baseball, I would say. Sausages and cured meats are very popular there. Wild game. Hunting is still allowed, limited and regulated, of course, but you can get wild game in the restaurants. Chestnuts, they have a lot of chestnut trees in the forest, so you'll find desserts made out of chestnuts. A very important crop now in Trentino is apples. So a lot of the apples in all of Italy are supplied from Trentino. So you'll see fields and fields of apples. So there are a lot of apple-based desserts, like apple strudel is a particularly the splendid dish that my cousins make when I show up. Polenta is a big thing. And polenta is cooked in a copper pot. It has to be copper, often cooked over an open fire in the authentic way. So polenta will be a big part of communal festivals. And it's stirred with a big wooden spoon, a big wooden paddle over the fire. You have to stir. It takes a lot of strength. It takes about an hour to stir and cook that way. And then it feeds the multitude. So it's a really good food for if you don't have very much and you want to feed a lot of people. I never had polenta growing up because it was kind of a poor person's food. And I think my mother was sick of it by the time that she was had her own family and was able to cook. So they had it so often, you know, you could feed a big family on polenta, put a little sauce over it. And if you were lucky, put meat sauce over it. And it's very filling. And it, you know, it's a good solid food, still very much part of the culture, the traditional culture there. But it's not a complete nutrition. And so in at times when that was all that the farming class had to eat, they developed a disease because, you know, they were malnourished. So you can't survive on polenta alone, but it was an important part of their food and is still celebrated as a traditional food.
I have had the pleasure of tasting some of the polenta dishes that you and your husband Rich have prepared, and they're delicious. What about the wine culture in Trentino, Mary Beth? Are there very many vineyards? Are there any notable wines that come from that region?
Yes, it's actually famous for its wine. There's a story that even at Roman times that Augustus would send to Trentino, you know, probably wasn't called that, it was called a different name. But if you look at the old maps, it would prefer the wine of Trentino. And there's numerous valleys that cut through the mountains. And the main river valley is the Adige, that is on the Adige River. And that's a famous wine growing area. There are other valleys that grow wine, but the Adige is famous. And when you're there, you're sort of entering into the limestone cliffs on either side, and then you see the vineyards down the center of the valley. So it's been a wine growing area, really as far back as the records grow. It's even the legendary origins are that the Etruscans taught them to how to grow wine, how to grow grapes for wine. So it's an extremely old part of the culture. The vineyards, you know, the roots go very deep as a result of that. And there are some outstanding wines that come only from there.
That is really interesting. I had no knowledge about the winemaking and grape cultivation in that area. So I know that there are Trentino clubs in the U.S. and around the world, and that you are an active member of the club in Seattle.
Yes, I am. Actually, this was a dream come true. You know, recovered, those are better verbs, my heritage, I felt like I had found a part of myself that I didn't even know about. And I was, and still am, always so happy when I get to go to Trentino, and really wishing that there was some part of that here where I live in the Northwest U.S. And I learned that there are Trentino clubs all over the world. They care about their people so much. You know, it was like a mother keeping track of her children. And so these clubs, they call them circolo, a circle, circoli, circles. There are circles of Trentini immigrants all over the world. And I always wished I had one here, but I didn't grow up where I'm living now. I grew up in Colorado. And so I convinced my sister Marlene to start a club where she lives. And it grew into a club of a couple hundred people at one time, I think. But I always wished there was one here where I lived. And so my dream came true. 10 years ago, I got a letter in the mail, and it was from a local woman, Joan Barker. And she said, I'm forming a Trentino club and we're having our first meeting. So 10 years ago, I was just so excited to get this letter. I didn't know how she found me, but we all met at a restaurant in Seattle, Washington. And the room was filled with people who had Trentino origins. And I was just so thrilled to be with my people. So that day we formed a club. Joan had written up the bylaws, and I was graciously asked to be vice president of the board. That was part of the rules, is we had to have a board. And so our club has been active ever since then. That was 10 years ago. We celebrated our 10-year anniversary this year in March. And yes, now I serve as president. It's a real joy of my life because we gather together. It's a social club, a cultural club. We have two big meetings a year, one in the winter. It's the winter festival. La Befana, the old woman who brings gifts on the Epiphany, comes to our party and gives gifts to the kids, and we have a potluck. And then in the summer, in August, we have a polenta picnic where we make polenta communally in a copper pot. And we always have a lot left over. So it's a really fun group of people. You don't have to be of Trentino origins to join our club. So any of your listeners are welcome to join if they're in this area. We have people in probably five different states. So Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Montana. So we're dispersed, but we try to get together once a year for the polenta picnic and celebrate our heritage.
Okay, thanks. For any of you who are interested in learning more about the Trentino Club in Seattle, I'll put the contact information in the show's notes for you. Okay, Mary Beth, I have one last question. What is it that you look forward to the most when you're visiting Trentino?
What I treasure more than anything is knowing real people that are my relatives and visiting with them. So that's always the most important thing that happens there, is sitting down at the kitchen tables of my cousins, and they prepare traditional foods for me, and it's just about as good as it gets to be at the kitchen tables of my relatives.
It always comes back to that human connection with the people, doesn't it? Thanks again, Mary Beth. Your stories and descriptions of this region have given me a whole new perspective of this very beautiful part of Italy. I hope you'll come back again and tell us about the folk heritage of this region, because I know you have studied that extensively also.
Oh, Andrea, I would love to. It's been so much fun being on your show and getting the chance to talk about Trentino, a place in the world that I truly love. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this episode of Italy Inside Out. This podcast is sponsored by Travel in Italia, leading small group tours on the mainland and islands of Italy. You can find more information at www.travelinitalia.com. If you enjoyed listening, please subscribe to this podcast. And until next time, arrivederci.